In June of 2023, headlines shook the nation as reports emerged of a shocking crime. Human remains stolen from the hallowed halls of Harvard Medical School's morgue, allegedly sold to buyers far and wide. As the case unfolded, a dark underworld of online human remains trade was revealed. The stolen remains, which had been meant for research and eventual return to families or burial, were instead sold for profit, leaving loved ones distraught and communities shaken. The resulting indictment revealed a web of individuals involved in the scandal, from the manager of the morgue, Cedric Lodge, to buyers across different states paying for transactions for body parts through online platforms like PayPal, using memos like Head Number 7. It's easy to read a story like this and quickly remove the human element because when stories are this awful, we prefer not to get too involved. But take a minute to imagine if your loved one was Head Number 7. Can you even begin to fathom the emotional turmoil that the families affected by this scandal must be experiencing? It's hard to imagine, but these families aren't alone. This is an old story that's been playing out over and over for centuries. I'm Layla Kelly, and this is Death Becomes Her. Today, I want to talk about medical cadavers. Let's briefly talk about medical cadavers and their importance to the field of medical education and research. First, they serve as invaluable tools for teaching anatomy, surgical techniques, and medical procedures. Cadavers provide a hands-on learning experience that can't be fully replicated by technology. They give students tactile understanding of the complexities of human anatomy in a real-life context. No doubt we breathe a sigh of relief knowing that our surgeons receive training on real bodies instead of having just read about a procedure, or maybe having practiced it in a digital simulation. And medical cadavers play a crucial role in advancing medical research and innovation. They provide scientists and researchers with a deeper understanding of the human body's structure and function. New treatments, surgical procedures, and medical devices can be developed thanks to medical cadavers. Disease pathologies have been explored, patient outcomes improved. We can all be grateful for the people who have given their bodies to medical science. It's no surprise then that a segment of our population chooses to donate their body to science. Many are motivated by a desire to contribute to medical education and research, benefiting society even after death. For others, it's a meaningful way to leave a lasting legacy and make a positive impact on future generations. Individuals facing terminal illnesses or contemplating their end-of-life plans may view donating their body as a way to claim a sense of purpose. Whatever the motivation, the choice to donate is generally seen as a selfless, altruistic act. But donation hasn't always been a choice, which is what we're going to look at today, the history of medical cadavers from the 1700s up to modern day. Spoilers, there's corruption, a lot of it. Whenever there's money to be made or something of value to be gained, someone will find a way to corrupt the process. And this is no different. The Harvard scandal is certainly not breaking new ground when it comes to exploiting the dead. Let's go back to April of 1788 with the New York Doctors' Riot. The Doctors' Riot was a violent uprising in New York City sparked by public outrage over the illegal procurement of bodies for medical dissection. This is how the story goes. It all started with suspicions that medical students and physicians were stealing bodies from the Black Cemetery. A petition was signed in February with the Common Council to take action against such practices, but for the most part, the petition was ignored. But the topic was on people's radar. So in April, when a medical student named John Hicks stood in an open window of a dissection lab and waved the disembodied arm of a cadaver at a group of playing children, things escalated quickly. It said that Hicks took it a step further, claiming that the arm had belonged to the recently deceased mother of one of the boys. The boy ran home, reported it to his dad. Dad exhumed his wife's coffin, found it empty, and then he and other outraged citizens descended upon the hospital. At least that's one version of how it all got started. Others have a different slant on the story, saying that the boy was curious and was peeking in on a dissection that was taking place, and then discovered that his mother's body was missing. Either way, once it was discovered that the woman's body was, in fact, missing, a mob gathered and, fueled by the perceived disrespect toward the deceased and the violation of burial grounds, they vandalized the hospital and destroyed anatomical specimens. Some big names, like Alexander Hamilton, tried to keep the peace. He allegedly pleaded with the crowd on the front steps of the school for calm and a return to order, but was, quote, shouted down and pushed past as the mob searched for evidence of dissection. Physicians were imprisoned just to keep them safe from the mob. The riot lasted for a few days and finally ended with the help of the militia and the cavalry. Ultimately, the riot did prompt changes in legislation to help regulate the procurement of cadavers for medical education. For example, 2 years later in 1790, a federal law was passed which permitted federal judges to add dissection to a death sentence for a murderer. That was all well and good, but it didn't change a whole lot. There still weren't enough medical cadavers. During the late 18th to 19th centuries, another disturbing practice emerged. Slaves' bodies were being sold to medical schools, and as you likely guessed, the deceased nor their families had agreed to this. As demand for cadavers increased in medical education, the bodies of deceased slaves were seen as a readily available source. Slaves' bodies were often considered expendable, their humanity disregarded by those engaging in this trade. Plantation owners, medical practitioners, and slave traders saw an opportunity to profit from the sale of these bodies to medical institutions. The lack of legal protections for slaves and their marginalized status made them vulnerable to such exploitation. In some cases, medical practitioners would directly approach slave owners or overseers to purchase bodies. In other instances, individuals involved in the slave trade would profit by selling bodies to medical schools. And occasionally, the slave owner himself was a doctor, so he could just cut out the middleman. This unethical practice not only commodified the deceased slaves, but also perpetuated the dehumanization and exploitation that characterized the entire institution of slavery. Slaves were traded as chattel in life, and their bodies were cashed in on in death. During the early 1800s, the quote-unquote resurrection men came on the scene, individuals who engaged in exhuming corpses from graves. The need for cadavers continued to grow, so resurrection men filled this demand by robbing graves and supplying cadavers to medical institutions. They were the original body snatchers. It was a difficult job that put them at risk of legal consequences and the wrath of communities who naturally despised the desecration of graves. So they developed plenty of tricks, which made them invaluable to medical schools. Writer Ambrose Bierce once said that a body snatcher is the one who supplies the young physicians with that which the old physicians have supplied the undertaker. He seemed to clearly see what was going on. All right, so let's talk about how these sneaky resurrection men operated back in the day. These guys were all about stealth. They'd wait until the cover of darkness to do their thing, digging up the graves and all of that. Naturally, darkness helped them stay under the radar and avoid the unwanted attention. Imagine sneaking around a graveyard like a ninja. That's what the resurrection men did. They had to be super quiet and quick about their work, so they developed methods for digging up bodies fast. They'd often target the fresh graves where the soil was softer, making it easier to dig them up without too much hassle. Not to mention, the fresher the grave, the fresher the cadaver, which was important for medical study. They didn't have to dig up an entire grave. They began by shoveling at the head of the grave, breaking the lid, placing a hook around the deceased's neck or armpit, and then with the help of a rope, eased the body out of the grave. Here's a fun little tidbit. Have you ever had a stiff drink? If a corpse was going to be shipped to a medical school that was elsewhere, the corpses were folded into barrels that were filled with whiskey. The whiskey would mask the odor of the corpse. At the destination, the medical school took the remains for dissection. The nasty whiskey left in the barrel could then be sold. It came to be called a stiff drink. At least that's one origin for the phrase, which is gross. Across the Atlantic in Scotland, the infamous duo Burke and Hare, though not traditional resurrection men, were part of a related phenomenon. They turned to serial murder to meet the demands for cadavers, adding a gruesome twist to the already dark history of obtaining bodies for medical education. First off, we've got William Hare, an Irishman who made his way to Scotland and settled into running a lodging house in Edinburgh. Then there's William Burke, also hailing from Ireland. He rolled into town in 1827. On November 29th, things took a dark turn when an old man died in Hare's lodging house. Hare was angry because the man died still owing him £4 in rent. So he and Burke cooked up a scheme to nab the lodger's corpse from its coffin and then sell it off to recoup their losses. With Burke's help, they managed to offload the body to a surgeon named Robert Knox for £7.10, which is about $700 in today's money. Just like that, the pair had recouped the losses and then some. It appeared to them that they had stumbled on a way to make easy money. But where are you going to just find these corpses? Over the next few months, with the help of their ladies, they lured in at least 15 unsuspecting travelers, got them good and drunk, and then suffocated them, making it look like they had just passed out. And guess where the bodies ended up? Yep, in Knox's anatomy school. But their little operation hit a snag when neighbors and the authorities caught wind of them murdering a local lady on October 31st, 1828. Hare wasn't about to go down for the murder, so he flipped on Burke, walked away scot-free, and disappeared into the shadows. Burke wasn't so lucky. He was slapped with a murder charge, found guilty, and ended up swinging from the gallows. That wasn't the last we saw of him. On February 1st, 1829, his body was publicly dissected at the University of Edinburgh's Anatomy Theater. The two-hour dissection took place in a crowded lecture hall. Burke's blood was used to write a message that read, "This is written with the blood of William Burke, who was hanged in Edinburgh. This blood was taken from his head." Also, gross. Meanwhile, both in the U.S. and U.K., people were trying all sorts of things to protect the bodies of their deceased loved ones. Some notable measures included mort-safe devices. These devices were mechanical contraptions placed over the graves, and they often featured iron bars or cages that could be locked. This prevented access to the coffin and the body that it contained. Booby traps. In some cases, graves were protected with booby traps such as rigged shotguns or alarms. These mechanisms were intended to surprise and discourage grave robbers attempting to disturb the burial sites. In 1878, Philip K. Clover expanded on the booby trap idea when he patented the coffin torpedo. This was a small shotgun inside the coffin lid. If someone tried to remove a buried body, the torpedo would fire a lethal blast of lead balls when the lid was open. A few years later, in 1881, Thomas N. Howell applied for a patent that was basically a landmine. It was a shell buried above the coffin that would explode when it was disturbed. One of my favorites is the iron coffin. A man named Almon Dunbar Fisk patented the Fisk Metallic Burial Case in 1848. It was very expensive and more for wealthier families or the affluent. This design had a variety of selling points, one use being its ability to deter grave robbers. It also featured a window so you could see the deceased without opening the coffin. All of these things were expensive and therefore only available to people with means. Others who feared grave robbers simply posted guards to watch the graves of their loved ones. Whatever method, these safeguards were responses to the grim realities of grave robbing. They reflected the community's determination to protect the sanctity of burial grounds and the dignity of their deceased. So, back to modern day. I'd like to say that grave robbing is a thing of history, but the Harvard story says otherwise. So does this story. In the mid-2000s, there was a very ugly story of body snatching. If you're a true crime enthusiast, which, oddly enough, it seems many of us are, you might be familiar with this one. Michael Mastromarino was at the center of a high-profile case involving a widespread body parts harvesting scandal that came to light in the mid-2000s. He was a former dentist turned entrepreneur who owned and operated a company called Biomedical Tissue Services. Mastromarino and his associates were accused of harvesting body parts, including bones, tissues, and organs, from deceased individuals without proper authorization. He developed a network of undertakers that were willing to sell bodies to him, often for $1,000 a corpse. Once a body had been obtained, documents were forged to make it appear as if the deceased or the family had consented to the donation of body parts. The body parts would be harvested and sold off without proper screening or testing for infectious diseases. In some cases, he took tissue from people who had died of cancer or AIDS, and then he made documents that falsified their cause of death. The scandals had significant consequences for individuals who unknowingly received tissues sourced from these illegal practices. Some claim to have suffered from life-threatening conditions as a result of receiving diseased tissues. The scheme went on for 4 years before Mastromarino was caught. In that time, he had made over $4 million. In 2008, Mastromarino was sentenced to 58 years in prison after being convicted on numerous counts. In 2013, he died in prison as the result of liver and bone cancer. So, what can we learn from all of this? Should we just opt out of body donation altogether? Fortunately, these modern-day examples are isolated incidents, and there are many reputable programs out there. If you're considering donating your body to science, it's crucial to be well-informed about the process and the implications. Here's what you should know. Informed consent. Understand the importance of informed consent. You or your designated representative should be fully aware of the details and the purposes of body donation. This includes knowing the possibilities of how your body will be used for research or medical education. There's a great book on this topic called Stiff, The Curious Life of Human Cadavers by Mary Roach. If you're considering donation, it's a good read. And even if you're not considering donation, I still find it fascinating. I believe I have read it twice. Research reputable programs. Investigate and choose a reputable body donation program or anatomical gift program that's associated with a medical school, research institution, or a university. Ensure the program has a track record of ethical practices and transparency. And don't hesitate to ask questions to make sure that you fully understand their process. Legal aspects. Be aware of the legal aspects and requirements associated with body donation. These may include specific documentation, consent forms, and any state or regional regulations governing anatomical donations. Communication with family. This one is really, really important. If you are making plans to donate your body, you should clearly communicate your decision with your family or next of kin. It is essential that they understand and support your choice, as they may very well be involved in the process after your passing. Maintain thorough documentation. Keep records of your decision to donate your body, including any legal paperwork, and inform your family of the location of these documents for easy access when needed. Alternative arrangements. Generally speaking, we can't predict the exact circumstances of our death. So be aware that certain medical conditions, circumstances of death, or geographical location may limit the eligibility for body donation. If your death doesn't meet the criteria, your donation can't be accepted. So be aware that unforeseen circumstances or changes in your health might impact your eligibility for body donation. Should donation become impractical, have an alternate disposition plan ready for your loved ones to follow. Post-donation plans. Inquire about the program's policies regarding the return of cremated remains after the research or educational use of the body. Understand the program's procedures for handling the remains and any associated costs, which then brings us to costs and transportation. So clarify whether the body donation program covers costs associated with transportation, preparation, and final disposition. Many programs do cover these costs, but others might require some kind of financial contribution from the donor or their family. And stay informed. As with all end-of-life plans, regularly review and update your plans to ensure that they align with your wishes and the current practices of the chosen program. Stay informed about any changes in the body donation program policies and procedures. By being well-informed and making thoughtful decisions, you can contribute to scientific and medical advancements and ensure that your body donation process aligns with your values and preferences. In the wake of disturbing incidents throughout history and in our modern era, it's evident that there are many things to consider when it comes to body donation. While the stories that we've considered today may be unsettling, they serve as reminders of the need for individuals to engage in end-of-life planning with diligence and care. So whether considering body donation or other arrangements, do your due diligence, research your options, communicate your intentions with loved ones, and stay informed about legal and logistical considerations. All of that can be easier said than done. That is something that I have come to realize while working with people at the end of life. Many people have very good intentions, but they don't follow through. I often think of it akin to taxes. It's something that we know we need to get done, but it's just not all that fun. So it can be hard to actually follow through. I want to tell you about something, though, that I have been working on in order to facilitate end-of-life planning, just making it easier. I've developed a program that I call End of Life Essentials, and it's an online course that combines a variety of videos and a 63-page workbook to walk you through end-of-life organization. Everything from the importance of advance directives to documenting your personal care preferences, funeral details, personal organization, and finally, leaving a lasting legacy. At the end of the course, you'll have all of your important information in one place. You'll know that you've provided everything that your loved ones need to care for you at the end of life, as well as after you've passed, and that they can care for you in a way that honors your wishes. And when the time comes, your loved ones won't be left scrambling to find important information or to make decisions that they hope would be okay with you. They won't be laying awake at night wondering if they did the right thing. It's peace of mind for both you and your loved ones. And it's an important step that we all need to take. You can learn more on my website, leavingwellmt.com. Whatever your end of life wishes, whether you would like a traditional burial, a green option, or you desire to contribute to meaningful advancements in science and medicine, make your wishes clear. Have conversations with loved ones. Remember, talking about death won't kill you. I promise. As always, thank you for listening to Death Becomes Her. If you have questions, comments, anything else, you can find me at leavingwellmt.com, or you can find me on Instagram at leavingwelldeathdoula. I'm Layla Kelly, and this has been Death Becomes Her.